Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mason Wilrich. I'm your chair for today's program. And this program is also being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Middle Eastern Forum. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Abbas Milani, Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and visiting professor in Stanford's Political Science Department. He's also co-director of the Iran Democracy Project at the Hoover Institution. Dr. Milani received his BA in Political Science and Economics at UC Berkeley in 1970 and his PhD in political science at the University of Hawaii in 1974. On a personal note, I enjoyed very much becoming acquainted with Abbas shortly after I returned from a fascinating trip to Iran sponsored by the Commonwealth Club in spring 2010. The best way I have found to introduce Dr. Milani is to share with you a paragraph from Fuad Ajami's insightful foreword to Milani's book published in 2010, The Myth of the Great Satan, A New Look at America's Relations with Iran. Stanford professor Abbas Milani brings to the Iranian struggle both immense learning and authenticity of his own personal background. Born in Iran in 1948, he was formed by the philosophical and political currents that blew through the country in post-World War II years. Like others of his generation, he felt the pull of the American presence in Iran. But after his education in the United States, he returned to Iran for his academic career, or so he thought. He returned in the 1970s when the old order, the reign of the Pahlavis, was coming apart. He did time in the Shah's prisons in the company of the Shah's politico-religious opponents, who would soon demolish that order and build their own radical utopia. Before long, he would run afoul of the new rulers and make his way to the United States. So today, Dr. Milani will discuss his new book, The Shah, which is a deeply researched biography of Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the last Shah of Iran, whose monarchy was overthrown by Ayatollah Khomeini. And I'm sure that many of you in the audience with me read the full column Wall Street Journal review of his book, a very favorable review. Following his remarks, Dr. Jalay Dai, a member of the Commonwealth Club's board, who was also born in Iran, will moderate the question and answer period. Please join me now in welcoming Abbas Milani.
Good evening. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you for that very generous introduction. I hope I will prove deserving. Let me tell you briefly about the book, and then I will focus more on the subject of Iran's nuclear program. That was the subject that I was asked to talk about. The book is a political biography of the Shah. It does cover his entire 37 year on the throne. It covers his 60 year life. It is the result of about 10 years of work. Within this 10 years, I have written other books. One of them was The Myth of the Great Satan that was mentioned. I also wrote a book called Eminent Persians, which is about the lives of 150 men and women who lived under the Shah, during the Shah. But during this 10 years, my essential focus has been the Shah. And I think he is clearly one of the pivotal figures, in my view, of the last half of the 20th century. I think with every passing day, it becomes clear that his fall precipitated a set of events that continue to unfold and the results of which are still unknown. I think the results of which are in some ways epochal in a sense that they have created a force. They have brought out of the bottle a genie called radical Islam, and that radical Islam, I think, is now increasingly feeling itself empowered to challenge not just the United States. I think that is very much a misreading of the situation. This radical Islam is challenging modernity. It is challenging a way of life we call a modern, democratic, secular, rational living, a way of life that has been more or less consensually accepted as a good way of life since the time of the Renaissance. And this revolution began a demodernizing movement. The attempt in the book has been to offer an image of him not based on personal likes or dislikes, but rather based on the documentary evidence. There have been at least a dozen books written about him. And obviously a question is, why do we need another one? We need another one because I think, first of all, that other books have been almost all commissioned books. They were either commissioned by the Shah's family and friends or by his foes. They were meant to demonize him or lionize him. An attempt to find the man beneath these surface solemnities of power, I think, has been wanting. Second of all, I think now is the first time where we can actually write an account of his life, because many of the most important documents that we would need to actually write this history were declassified. Some of the documents became declassified as I finished the book. I had to delay the publication of the book for about 2 months so that I could read about 1,000 pages of new documents that were declassified about the subject of tonight's discussion, Iran's nuclear program. Although it did not change fundamentally what I had earlier written about this in other publications, but it gave a great deal of more substance and a great deal of more intimate understanding of what was happening. Now, for much of the Shah's life, and he came to the throne in 41, and he left in 79, and he died shortly thereafter of cancer, an issue that he decided, for reasons that are very unclear, to hide from almost everybody till it was far too late. In other words, he did not tell the Iranian people that he had cancer. He tried to hide it from the U.S., from England. As far as I can gather, the only country that might have known, is Israel. I talked to the Israeli ambassador, Lubrani, and I interviewed him, and he said that as soon as the French doctors came to Iran to take the Shah's blood and find out that he had cancer, the French ambassador told Lobrani, and Lobrani filed the report, and he says that the foreign ministry, Israeli foreign ministry, essentially dismissed it. The Israeli foreign ministry said more or less that if nobody knows, if the Americans don't know, if the British don't know, if the KGB doesn't know, how come we are the only one to know this? This might be misinformation or disinformation. But there is very little evidence. I have found one report, and I've mentioned in the book. It is a very, very classified, highly confidential report. It was a report written by Iran's ambassador at the time, Ardeshir Zahedi, and it was so sensitive that Zahedi wrote it in hand. He would not even trust his secretary with typing it, and send it in a special package, essentially, that they had set up just for this purpose. And the Shah wrote these responses on the margin. There are some of these reports that are truly remarkable, and I'm happy to say that Ardeshir Zahedi has decided to dedicate them to Stanford University. So they will be coming to Stanford, and they will make our library easily the best for the Pahlavi period. In one of those, an American official does refer to the fact that is the Shah feeling well physically and mentally, and the Shah very quickly dismisses the question as an idiotic question. 73 is when he was feeling at the height of his power. He was very dismissive towards everybody, including the Americans. This is the period when he is preaching to the Americans. And at the end of the note, he writes something remarkable. He says, it is not them that should be worrying about us. It is me that is worrying about the future of America. In other words, in 1973, he thought the future of America is much more shaky than his. 1973 is also the year that the Shah decides that he wants a nuclear program. I think it is fair to say that up to 1965, for the Shah, the symbol of progress, the symbol of modernity and industrialization, of having arrived, was a steel mill. His father tried to build one. He couldn't. Hitler promised him one, never arrived. And that deal probably, the deal with the Hitler probably helped cause the father's demise in 41. But the Shah bought a steel mill from the Soviet Union in 65. And 1972, the new sine qua non of progress was now a nuclear program. The Shah needed to have a nuclear program. And he could afford a nuclear program because there was now much more money that he could do his plans and his wildest imaginations make them into reality. And finally, he needed the nuclear program for the purpose that by 1973, Iran had clearly categorically become the dominant hegemonic force in the Persian Gulf. From 1965, Britain was planning to move all of its forces out of the Gulf, and the Shah made it very clear immediately that Iran is going to replace England as the dominant force. When Nixon came to power and the Nixon doctrine became America's foreign policy dogma, the Shah's dream was much more easily realizable. So the Shah, Iran, became the dominant force. And in the book, I describe how from 72, for example, to 75, Iran was engaged with the help of Israel and the United States in a covert operation against Saddam Hussein in Iraq. For 3 years, millions of dollars were spent on that project. So in order to complement and complete his role as the hegemon, the nuclear program was what he needed to have. Within very short time, literally within 3 weeks, 2 weeks, he commissions Akbar Etemad, a very brilliant Iranian nuclear physicist, to develop a plan for Iran's nuclear program. And just that simply, a plan that was to cost initially $1.5 billion first year, was soon increased to several billion, was developed and approved and became the blueprint for Iran's nuclear program. Now, one of the essential lies, I would say, that the Islamic Republic has told the world for the last 20 years is that the United States has engaged in what it calls, the regime calls, double standards, a hypocrisy. The argument they make is that the United States easily gave the Shah everything the Shah wanted, but now that we are in power, the regime, now that we are standing on their way and on the way of Israel, they are denying us the things they were giving the Shah. This is not accurate. It is not accurate in the sense that these documents that have been recently declassified show unambiguously that the United States was, in fact, in a very fierce, behind-the-scenes battle with the Shah on the nature of Iran's nuclear program. Many of the issues that are today the intractable problems between Iran and the United States, between Iran and IAEA, between Iran and the United Nations, were very much the same issues that were the problem between the Shah and the United States, circa 73 to 77. And these documents show that the United States was very much worried that what the Shah had in mind was not a peaceful nuclear program, that the Shah was moving towards something else. They were worried that the Shah was going to build a bomb, and they were worried that this would completely change the map of that region, as it would, as Iran's acquisition of such a bomb would change the map today, would change it in very serious ways. So while Europeans were, in fact, completely willing to sell the Shah what he wanted, in fact, they were in a kind of a bidding war with one another to see who could get into the market first. In fact, the German government, for example, guaranteed the investment of any nuclear company that would invest in Iran. That's how much they wanted German companies to get into the market and steal it from the Americans. To their credit, Ford and Carter administrations for 4 years stopped any American company from bidding on these reactors before they could find reassurances that the Shah was not, in fact, planning to build the bomb. And to his credit, the Shah was unwilling to give assurances that were not within NPT. The Shah repeatedly told both the Ford administration and the Carter administration that I will not give any guarantees. I will not accept any limits that are not within the NPT, Non-Proliferation Treaty. Part of the problem is with NPT. The NPT that was agreed and developed, and Iran was one of the first countries to sign it in 1971, is that, in fact, it allows for a country to develop a nuclear program, a full enrichment program, even a full fuel cycle. The letter of the law says that if you give up your dream of developing a bomb, we, the countries that have the technology, will give you all the help you need to have a peaceful nuclear program. And you can enrich if you want, but you have to do two things. You have to forego the desire for the bomb. Two, you have to not lie and cheat. The Islamic regime, when it came to power, one of the first decisions it made, one of the first decisions Khomeini made, was to stop the nuclear program. The Bushehr nuclear program that the Germans, Siemens, was building was 75% finished. It would have been finished by 1981 had Khomeini not unilaterally, decided that this is junk, he called it. The Americans have forced this on the Shah because he was their lackey. We don't want this. And his aides tried to convince him that, look, 75% finished. What are we going to do with the building? And he is famously supposed to have said, use it as a silo to save grain in. Well, they didn't use it as a silo because Saddam Hussein bombed it, and bombed it at least three times when Iran's eight-year war came. During that war, Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons against Iran, and the international community, I think to its shame, decided not to do anything about it. They decided not to punish Saddam, as they should have. Even the United States decided to look the other way. The Iranian regime at that time decided that it was going to relaunch its nuclear program. It decided that it needed to have its own insurance. But they decided to relaunch it not according to IAEA rules, that is transparent, but covertly. And they decided to lie and cheat and lie and cheat and lie and cheat. I say three times because they have been taken to the UN three times, and you have to be caught lying and cheating before you can be referred to the UN. So the regime basically started a program completely away from the international eyes. And according, again, to their own documents, the regime's documents, what they were trying to do to literally translate the words of Mr. Rouhani, who led the program, was they were trying to do a North Korea. That is, they were trying to secretly build the program and have it ready one step away from their final plan, whatever their final plan was, and then tell the world about it. Have the world face a fait accompli. But something happened on their way. The United States found out. And the United States found out essentially through a set of both accidents and lucky, fortuitous concurrence of events, and the fact that A.Q. Khan, Mr. Khan, was exposed. Khan was the nuclear physicist, Pakistani nuclear physicist, who stole the design for a centrifuge from Holland, took it back to Pakistan, and began selling it to the highest bidder, and Iran including. And since the United States and Europe and IAEA began to discover these cheats and lies. For example, when they found out that there is a site that Iran has never reported called Natanz. Iran for a while denied there was such a site. Then they agreed that there was such a site, but they denied that any enrichment had gone, had taken place there. And when they eventually allowed IAEA visitors to come in, IAEA found out that there was residue enrichment there, they said this must have come from one of the centrifuges we bought. So they repeatedly tried to hide this. And their argument is that the reason they tried to hide it was because they were worried about the potential Israeli or an American attack. Natanz, for example, is built under 25 feet of concrete. 25 feet on concrete. The only thing that can potentially get to it is said to be nuclear-tipped bunker busters. And they will have enormous consequences in terms of human lives, innocent human lives. So when the Shah was going through this process, he was engaging in what are called dual-track purchases. Iran was doing things that simply didn't make sense during the Shah's period if you were only having a peaceful nuclear program. Iran's chief nuclear scientist, Akbari Etemad, says in his memoirs that I noticed these rather unusual purchases, and I decided to have it out with the Shah. He says, I went to His Majesty and said, I am the head of the nuclear program. If you want to build the bomb, I need to know it. And the Shah, Etemad says, sat him down and gave him a 45-minute lesson in geostrategy. The gist of the lesson was, we don't want the bomb yet. We want to have the capacity to have the bomb in short order if anybody in the neighborhood has the bomb. Iran was worried about Saddam Hussein's nuclear program as early as 1968. The Shah, I think to his credit, understood that Saddam Hussein, if he gets the chance, will attack Iran. I've outlined in the book how Iran's entire military posture began to change after 1959, after the rise of nationalists in Iraq. Up to 1959, Iran's military posture was based on what Eisenhower had called the Zagros Line strategy. Zagros is the name of a mountain. The idea was that Iran should have a military to stop the Soviets at Zagros till the Marines can come to the rescue. After 59, the idea was no longer Zagros. The idea was to fight Iraqi possible invasion. Where they built air bases, where they built radar stations, was all after 59 based on that. And from 68, they began to worry that Saddam, that the Ba'ath regime, at that time he was number two, might be going after a nuclear bomb. So Iran was trying at that time to have the knowledge and the capacity to build a bomb in short order if anybody else did it. And one of Iran's chief allies in this effort, in this period, you would be surprised maybe, some of you might not, but was Israel. Israel was in fact engaged in certain deals with Iran on Iran's nuclear program that both Iran and Israel tried to hide from the United States. The Project Jericho, for example, aspects of the Project Jericho, according to Israeli sources, for example, were meant to be not clearly discussed with the United States. Israel saw Iran, rightly, I think, as its most important ally in the Muslim world. I think in those days it was probably at least as important as Turkey. And thus strengthened Iran was to Israel's benefit. So the Shah at one time even let slip in France in an interview that Iran will have a bomb sooner than anybody thinks. They immediately went into damage control. They realized that the Shah had slipped, that he had made a wrong comment, and they went in full throttle and diplomatic counterattack, saying that the Shah had not said this, Le Monde had misunderstood it. But I think the evidence is, in my mind, very clear. That's what the Shah was trying to do. He was trying to have a dual technology capacity, and he was trying to be ready in case anybody else had the bomb. My sense is that at least minimally, this is what this regime is trying to do. In other words, they're doing everything they can to develop the capacity to build a nuclear bomb and the capacity to deliver it. Shahab 3 is clearly being groomed and refashioned and redesigned for that purpose. They have made many, many purchases on the international market that cannot make sense for any reason other than an attempt to go in that direction. I think they want to become a virtual nuclear state. In other words, at least another Japan. That is, a country that has the technological capacity to build a bomb but has made the political decision not to build it and could build it at very short order. They might make the political decision to go the next step and make the bomb. They're clearly developing, searching for technologies to deliver a bomb. As I said, Shahab 3 and what they're doing with these missile technologies, I think makes no sense other than for this purpose. And they have been very clever in how they have gone about it. If you look at the way they have negotiated in the last 10, 12 years, they have been very clever in tactically, but they have been strategically very stupid. They have been strategically very stupid because Iran could have had a nuclear program in 1981, as I said. There was no reason why they should have disrupted it. And if they had been transparent about it, again, a country that had the capacities that Iran had, had the technological, the know-how capacity, the number of Iranians with PhDs in astrophysics, nuclear physics from MIT. The Shah had given $20 million to MIT to train a certain number of nuclear physicists every year. If they had not gone this path, strategically, I say, they might easily have achieved what is not a very great achievement. I mean, to learn how to enrich uranium is not cutting-edge technology. To bring the country to the precipice of economic collapse because you want to learn how to enrich uranium just doesn't make scientific sense. It doesn't make nationalistic sense. If you're interested in the welfare of a country, you go after cutting-edge technology. Iranian students are now denied access to many of the top universities because Ahmadinejad wants to enrich uranium. I mean, that doesn't make sense unless you have that goal in mind, the goal of at least having the technology to build the bomb. And I think one of the reasons everyone around the world, not just Israel or the United States, is worried about that possibility is that I think it is a fair assumption that if Iran develops a bomb, you can be sure that you are going to see the end of the NPT regime. NPT regime has been very successful in limiting the number of countries with access to a bomb to 11. One of the scholars has developed a model that predicts that if there had been no NPT, today there might have been at least between 35 to 40 countries with a nuclear capacity. So with NPT gone, I think we're facing a much more perilous world. And if Iran becomes dominant, all you have to do is look at these WikiLeaks documents and see how worried the Arabs are about a hegemonically strengthened Iran. You can bet your last bottom Apple stock that if Iran becomes nuclear, the Saudis will immediately go after it, the Kuwaitis will try to go after it, United Arab Emirates, Egypt has already started, some of these countries have already started, Turkey will attempt it. So you will see an arms race that I think will change the face of that region. And it is a very volatile region. And the idea that you have many of these truly lethal weapons in hands of regimes that are not very stable. What has happened in Tunisia should be a warning to all countries in the region and all analysts in this country who think that the countries in that region are stable. If you have traveled to that region, if you have studied that region, you would know it is a powder cake. Tunisia was a fully established, authoritarian, dictatorial, stable regime 2 weeks ago. Look at it today. The rest of the countries are not any better. Some of them are even worse. And thus, many nuclear weapons in many of these countries and many of the radicals, very influential in any of these countries, makes it truly a horrendous possibility. In my mind, I have no doubt that if one of these radical groups gets his hand on one of these weapons, they will detonate it. They will not hesitate for a moment to do so. I'm not talking about the regimes, because the regimes might be more rational because they know there is a day of reckoning. They know if you hit Israel, Israel has 200 bombs and it has a capacity for second strike and third strike, and it has a nuclear submarine right off the coast of Indian Ocean. But if you are a terrorist group with no responsibility, no place where you can be held responsible, your recklessness knows no limit. So it is an enormously important issue. And what is beginning to happen, I think, to tomorrow in Turkey, the new rounds of discussions, I would be extremely surprised if they resolve anything. I think the Iranian regime is dedicated to pursuing this program to its end, and its end is either minimally a virtual nuclear state Iran or an Iran equipped with a nuclear bomb, and that possibility does not bode well for the future of democracy in Iran, and it does not bode well for the future of the region. I think I have to stop.
Our thanks to Dr. Abbas Milani, Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and co-director of the Iran Democracy Project at the Hoover Institution. He is the author of the new book, The Shah. I'm Jaleh Dai, and I'm a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and I have the distinct pleasure and honor to moderate the audience's question period. Looks like we have a very curious audience with lots of questions, so if we may begin. The first question that I'd like to pose to you is somebody's asking, what can you tell us about the recent press stories about the secret software that corrupted the programs of the nuclear program? And doing that, how much time did we buy?
Well, it is, I think the reference is to a virus that was introduced into Iran's nuclear program. There is increasing evidence that it was developed in Israel with the help of Israeli and American engineers over a long period of time with the expenditure of considerable sums of money, because it is a very, very sophisticated software. From reports in the New York Times, you might have read it, they even recreated Iran's nuclear facility in this site in Israel in order to be able to reproduce what this might do. And what it does is essentially it blinds the computer that is supposed to control the centrifuges from really understanding what is going on in the centrifuge. The centrifuge might be churning out of control, and this will deny the computer the knowledge to shut it down. And thus, it is estimated that Iran has already lost about 1,000 of its centrifuges. Iran denies that it has been hit, but every indication is that it is serious. It has done damage. The outgoing head of Mossad, and Mossad has never been overly cautious about its estimates of Iran's nuclear program. If anything, they have erred on the side of overemphasizing the threat and the imminence of the threat. They now say that at least till 2015, they have bought enough time for that. So there's at least another 3.5-4 years for diplomacy to and sanctions to do its work.
The next question comes directly from your book and interpretation of what you are presenting in the book. You emphasize quite a bit on the religious tendencies of the Shah. Was he unique within his culture? Our own leaders, including our own founding fathers, have expressed their belief in provenance and divine's hand, so to speak. What is so unique about the Shah and his religious tendencies?
That's a very good question. The Shah is not unique in having religious tendencies. A lot of people do. A lot of leaders do. But when you get into difficulties is not in the book, at least, I don't say that the problem was created because he had religious beliefs. The problem was created because the Shah essentially followed a scorched earth policy towards everybody except the clergy. In other words, the Iranian Democrats, the Iranian Social Democrats, the Iranian leftists were not allowed to organize, mobilize. They were absolutely shut down. There was one force that was allowed to build a unit in every neighborhood, that was allowed to train its own cadres, that was allowed to collect money, that was allowed to have a national network. And when the system went into crisis in 1978, and Britain and the United States began to look around to see who could hold the country together, who could hold the country together and fight communism, and these are, what I'm saying, are based on documents from the American and the British archives. I'm not making these things up. They found religious forces to be the only force, the only social force capable of holding the country together. Every other force in the country was denied access to the political process. The Shah himself knew by 1972-73 that his regime was vulnerable politically. I describe in some detail his meetings. He met for 6 months with a man named Mehdi Essami'i, one of the most well-known, one of the most respected public servants in Iran. He just died, a man who handled billions of dollars and died in absolute middle-class difficult existence in Los Angeles. Really one of the most honorable men I've ever met in my life. He talks to Sami'i for 6 months and tells Sami'i, come and start a political party that could mobilize people, that could get people involved. And it's remarkable that I have found the minutes of these discussions. Sami'i kindly shared them with me. But then the price of oil quadrupled, and the Shah not only did not create this potentially saving party, democratic alternative party, but went towards creating a pseudo-fascist, banal single-party system called the Rastakhis. When he should have opened up the system, when he was at the height of his power and could have helped create a democratic alternative, he created the Rastakhis. In the meantime, allowing the clergy to build, encouraging the clergy to build. I offer some statistics on the number of mosques that were built in Iran in the last 15 years of the Shah's power. It is remarkable. It's the fastest decade for any statistical period we have. It was Savak's and the Shah's strategic vision that his main threat came from the left and from the center, the Democrats, and that in this fight, the religious forces were his allies. The mistake the CIA made in Afghanistan in thinking that you could use bin Laden against Soviet Union and bin Laden will not become a problem for you, the Shah made in Iran from 1941 to 1979. He changed his father's policies. He brought back the clerics his father had thrown out of the country. He changed some of the rules in favor of the clergy. He introduced religious teaching in Iranian schools. Tehran University was built by his father. Did not have a mosque. As a university, why should the university have a mosque? You want to have a mosque built outside. The son built a university, a mosque at Tehran University, and built it in the metaphoric and physical center of the university, where every day when I went to my office, I looked up to the power of the divine before I entered the eminently secular law school. That was what created the problem, not his private religious beliefs.
Another audience asks, can you please explain the reason why the Shah, in his answer to history, in his book Answer to History, mentioned a rift with Ardashir Zahedi, something about being betrayed by Zahedi, although he didn't elaborate. Can you enlighten us?
Well, I can, yes. I have interviewed Zahedi for many days and hours. I have probably about 200 hours of tapes, and I have used his archive, which is really the most important archive for the Shah outside Iran. The answer to history, in my view, is a profoundly misguided book. It should not have been written, because it does not answer to history at all. It repeats some of the same stereotypical answers that the Shah had given earlier in his memoirs. Instead of coming clean and saying the truth, he held back and he repeated some clichés. And from what I understand, some of his advisors, including Zahedi, were against the idea of publishing the book. And they were against the idea of the Shah not accepting some criticism for what his own errors were. The gist of the book is that I did everything right, and the people of Iran were too ignorant to understand what I was doing for them. Now, it might well be true that the people of Iran did make a mistake, but it was his policies that pushed them in the direction of making that mistake almost inevitable. And when Zahedi apparently tells him, why don't you put some criticism, the only criticism the Shah puts in the book is of Zahedi himself. And the criticism that he makes of Zahedi, I have to be also very, it's important to remember, he says, I should not have kept Zahedi because contrary to what Zahedi says, said to me that he had extensive contacts, he did not have very many contacts, and he had troubled relationship with the Carter administration. Well, I can tell you with some certainty, after having looked at his archive, after having looked at the letters written to him by American presidents, vice presidents, senators, congressmen, it's remarkable how extensive his contacts were. His parties were notorious in those days, you know, from Elizabeth Taylor to Senator Percy. So to say that his only mistake was to keep Zahedi in power is an attempt to not offer any criticism of himself and blaming it on somebody else that he knew would not criticize him. He did not blame it on others. He knew Zahedi would not ever criticize him. Zahedi could have criticized the Shah for the last 30 years, but he has remained enormously dedicated to the man. I have never yet met him. I told you how many hours of tape I have of him. I've never met him where he would call the Shah by anything other than His Royal Majesty in private conversation. So it is the kind of a mistake that I think made the book, unfortunately, not an answer to history, but an escape from history.
Just a reminder for our radio audiences, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest today is Dr. Abbas Milani, Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University, who is discussing the history of relations between the U.S. and Iran during the Shah's reign. All right, another question, a two-part question, and I'll ask the first one, the second one first. When is there going to be a Farsi edition of your book?
When I finish it. I am working on it. I'm working on translating it. Some of you might know. No, I think most of you probably don't know that the regime has recently published a list of what it called subversive writers and subversive publishers. Fortunately, I'm on that list. And it means that it might not get permission to publish, but I'm dedicated to translating it and making it available to people in Iran. My earlier book on Hoveyda, which is the Shah's prime minister, has been very popular in Iran. It's gone through very many prints. And so the regime will not succeed in stopping people from reading the book if they want it.
The second part of that question, or the first part of that question is, if you could ask two questions from the Shah, what would they be?
Two questions?
Yeah. Only two.
The one would be, why were you in such a hurry to leave Iran? Hmm. I think he made an enormous error in judgment in leaving Iran. And the second one would be, why did you not open up the system when you had the political capital to do it? In 1974, if he had opened up the system, if he had allowed a loyal opposition party, I cannot imagine that that loyal opposition could not have saved him in 1978. You know, I've been working on this, I told you, about 10 years. One thing that has become, to me, crystal clear is that this revolution was not inevitable. Change in Iran was inevitable because, to some extent, of the changes the Shah had himself made. He made Iran a modern, middle-class, urban, much more educated, with women enfranchised. He created in the Iranian people a sense of entitlement. They wanted to be equal to the best of them in any country in the world. These were very important accomplishments. I mean, what the father and son have done to Iran is really remarkable in a span of 50 years. They took a country that was on the verge of collapse, and they left a country that was highly, rapidly industrializing with $25 billion in foreign currency accounts, a large middle class, an educated technocratic class. And to not open up the system when he could have is really a remarkable tragedy.
Okay, next question. What is your sense of the Iranian people's hopes and aspirations? Is a future constitutional monarch as a symbol of the nation as opposed to a head of a state is part of that dream or hope and aspirations?
Well, I can't assume to speak for the people of Iran, but every experience that I have had, everything I have read, everything I continue to read on a daily basis from Iran tells me that this regime is dead. It is politically dead. Iranian society has outgrown this regime. Iranian society has become a complicated, cosmopolitan, highly developed, internet-savvy nation. 32 million people connected to the internet. Look at the writing that is coming out of Iran. Look at the films that have been made by Iranian women or Iranian men. Look at the music that has been coming out of Iran. Look at the novels. Look at the number of women writers. Society has changed And this regime, literally like a bad dream, is holding on to power. So for me, there is no doubt in my mind that the future of Iran is a democratic future, and it is a future where people will decide who rules over them themselves. They will not allow accidents of history, accidents of birth, accidents of inheritance, accidents of appointment to determine who rules over them. They will themselves decide who will rule over them. This is a 100-year dream in Iran. And one of the first people to die for that dream was an American teacher by the name of Howard Baskerville. Baskerville fought for the constitutionalists in Iran, died for it, took on the one of the most heroic tasks. If you ever, if they ever make a film about this, he will look too heroic to be real, but he was truly that heroic. That dream is now 100 years old. Everything society needs for democracy is now more ready in Iran than it has ever been. The brutality of the regime can delay what is inevitable, but it cannot change it.
Another question is, could you comment on the recent tragic suicide of the Shah's son? Are you in touch with anybody who might know a little bit about the situation?
Well, almost everybody in the Iranian diaspora thinks they know about the situation, and everybody has been commenting on it. For me, first of all, the most important aspect is a personal tragedy. The idea of the queen having two children commit suicide in the span of 10 years, to me, is just remarkable. You would need the patience of Job to tolerate this. Clearly, the man was very different from the rest of his family. He was the only child of the Shah who was given to scholarship. He did almost all of the work necessary for a PhD at Harvard in ancient Iranian history. He had a master's from Columbia, a bachelor's from Princeton. He was also clearly clinically depressed. The Shah was depressed. I describe it in the book at some length. The Shah was very much a depressed character. Sometimes he went into manic modes, drive fast cars, drive motorcycles, boats, planes to dangerous limits. And sometimes he would go into these truly depressive moments of stupor. So I think he inherited some of that. And I think the tragedy of seeing his sister's death, suicide, his sister committed suicide about 10 years ago, the death of his father, and the fall from the height of power and wealth to being left literally no country that would give him a visa. It is just remarkable. The mendacity of some of the leaders of this world who milked the Shah when he had Iranian capital to give away. He gave away almost $1.5 billion. The CIA calls it a lending binge. And the same countries who took those money from him, the same countries that he had been an ally of for 37 years, would not allow him even a visa to come and die in peace. The only person that had the chivalry and the nobleness of soul to do it is Anwar Sadat. I cannot tell you how, in retrospect, he seems heroic and the rest of these leaders look like small men and women who wanted, who thought of nothing other than their paltry economic needs. The fear that Britain might lose a portion of the market share caused Margaret Thatcher, who had sworn to the Shah that she would give him safe harbor, to reject it. The Shah accepts it. Every country, Jordan whose king had regularly benefited from the Shah's largesse that came from the Iranian people ultimately, but largesse nevertheless, would not allow him to visit Jordan when the Shah was. So to see that, I think it moves anybody, depresses anybody. In that kind introduction, they said, I was an opponent of the Shah. I spent a year in prison. But when I first read the stories of his last year, in a very great book called Shah's Last Ride by William Shawcross, I truly wept because I thought, he might have been, and he did make many mistakes. But no human being deserves this. No human being deserves this.
President Carter visited Tehran New Year's Eve 1977, just a few months before the turmoil came to be on public television all over the world. He toasted him as an island of stability, and so on and so forth. Did President Carter knowingly misled an ally, as well as the American public, about intentions regarding U.S. policy towards the Shah and Iran in a few months down the road?
I think implied in this theory, this question, as I'm sure all of you understand, is a belief that there was a conspiracy by Carter to get rid of the Shah. Many royalists believe that this was the case. The Shah himself certainly believed it. He believed that both the British and the Americans, he sometimes also adds the Soviets, conspired to get rid of him. I don't share that belief at all. But I don't also say that Carter bore no responsibility. I think Carter bore a great deal of responsibility because he was out to lunch. And his policies on Iran were riven between two camps, Brzezinski, who clearly understood what was happening and was worried, and Vance, his State Department Secretary of State. And he himself was preoccupied with Camp David, was very much preoccupied, very little paying attention to Tehran burning, literally. And in this chaos and in this vacuum, American ambassador in Iran, whose ignorance of Iranian reality was matched only by his arrogance, was forming his own foreign policy. Carter, in his most recent book, says, became very close to firing him because he was following his own foreign policy. It is that confusion and chaos and contradictory policies and Shah's own indecisiveness, added to by the fact that he had cancer and was undergoing chemotherapy and was taking pills that created paranoia and indecision. These are written on the pill box. That combination brought the Shah down. And the mistakes that the Iranian opposition made. If we want to blame everybody who bears some blame, the Shah bears some blame, but the Iranian opposition bears some blame. The Iranian opposition chose as its leader for a democratic revolution a man who had clearly, categorically, unmistakably said that democracy is a gimmick of the West to undermine Islam. They made that mistake. That was all of these combined errors created what in the book is called the perfect storm. It was that perfect storm that created the revolution. It wasn't Jimmy Carter alone. It wasn't the British alone. It wasn't the Shah alone. It wasn't the Iranian people alone. It wasn't Khomeini who lied to the Iranian people about his intentions while he was in Paris, not in his writings, but in his Paris days. That combination created the perfect storm that changed Iran and has changed much of the region ever since.
Unfortunately, we have reached a point in our program where we have time just for one quick question. There is still a small community of Jewish people in Iran, as well as Zoroastrians. Do you think they have a comfortable, normal life, or are they under huge pressures and oppression?
Well, first of all, it is not a small community. There are 20,000 Jews who live in Iran. That is down from about 125,000. There are still more Jews living in Iran than the entire rest of the Muslim world put together. Out of that 125,000 initially, 100,000 of them left, and 25,000 approximately have decided to stay. Clearly, when you have a regime whose rhetoric is anti-Semitic, who's constantly talking about the destruction of Israel, who thinks anybody who's a Jew is potentially a Zionist, as they call it, makes life uncomfortable. But nevertheless, the truth of the matter is that these people have decided to stay. Israel has made many sweet offers to entice them to leave, to make it possible for them to leave, but they consider themselves Iranian, and they are Iranians. They are as much Iranian as any Iranian. In fact, they're more Iranian than Muslims. Jews have lived in Iran longer than Muslims have. Jews have lived in Iran for 3,000 years. Zoroastrians has lived in Iran 3,000 years. Islam is 1,200 years old. So this is their country, and some of them have decided to stay. But unfortunately, the mendacities of anti-Semitism, I can only imagine, makes life uncomfortable for them.
Thank you. Our thanks to Dr. Abbas Milani, Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University, co-director of the Iran Democracy Project at the Hoover Institution, and author of the new book, The Shah. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and on the Internet. This program has been held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Middle East Forum. I'm Jaleh Dai, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, where you are in the know, is adjourned.
I've always wanted to do this.
Thank you for a wonderful program.